We're continuing our study of the eldership tonight and the qualifications of elders. We've already had a few lessons on this part of our overall study about elders in the Lord's church. We're actually spending the bulk of our time now digging into the qualifications and trying to understand these, and particularly as they pertain to and relate to the work and responsibilities that elders have in the church. We're also looking at these particular things that God gives as a requirement for someone to serve as an elder in the church as encouragement and further teaching on general things that we all need as Christians to be pursuing. These are good things that would be for all of us to seek after, to meet as qualifications in our own lives, just in the general sense. But of course, the Lord does require these things of those who would serve as an elder or as elders in His church. We want to continue our study tonight in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3. We started that verse last time with the qualification of not being given to wine. The next one we see in verse 3 is no striker. Now, that word striker is a word that means a smiter, somebody who is smiting or hitting someone in the general sense, somebody who's pugnacious, somebody who is given to getting into fights. Now, this could be literal fisticuffs. This could be in physical altercations, but also is a word that applies to being quarrelsome. Now, it shouldn't be real difficult to see why that would not be something that an elder in the church would be, it would be good for them to be like. Somebody who is a striker would not want somebody serving in that capacity to be somebody who is given to getting into quarrels and fighting with people, particularly to the point where they may even literally be striking them. Now, it may sound like, well, why would that even be given as a qualification or even be mentioned? Well, there were some even in the church during this first century that were passing themselves off as apostles. If you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he speaks about in this chapter these different ones who were among them. They were in Corinth, and things that they were doing. And Paul was trying to cut off the occasion that they were desiring, that they were things they were boasting in, and things they were trying to seek an opportunity to accuse Paul of. And he's speaking of that in verse 12. And then verse 13, he says, "For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed, as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works." Going back to the beginning of this chapter, Paul was expressing his fear that these Corinthians would be corrupted, have their minds corrupted by the same tactics that the devil used in beguiling Eve in the garden. He mentioned that in verse 3. So he's talking about these ones who were the threats to corrupt them. And he calls them these false apostles. They were ministers of Satan himself. But he goes on to describe things that they were doing that were in contrast to the way Paul was treating them. And he says in verse 20, "For you suffer," that means you allow, "if a man bring you into bondage, if a man devour you, if a man take of you, if a man exalt himself, if a man smite you on the face." Look at the things that they were doing. They were taking their... These ones who were among them that were passing themselves off, claiming to be apostles, making themselves the leader. They were leaders. They were teaching these false doctrines. They were physically abusing these people as well as taking their money from them. And of course, Paul is in this chapter, and the Lord through Paul is making the distinction between these false apostles and the true apostle that they knew, Paul, very clear. The differences couldn't be greater. Paul was one that wouldn't even take any money from them at all to help him when he was laboring among them, even though by right he could ask for their financial support. But he didn't want to take anything from them. Wanted to keep that difference very clear between him and these other ones around there. And so he didn't take any money from them at all, even when he was spending his time laboring among them to teach them. And he would not do anything to abuse them in any way. He was doing only what was good for them. He was not even misusing the authority that he had as an apostle. He was using that authority for their good, to edify them, not for destruction, something that he mentions in chapter 13 and verse 10. But here were some among them that were making themselves to be leaders that were physically abusive. Well, he's very clear in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 3, that an elder in God's church cannot behave that way. Paul would be the example to follow there as far as the way to properly treat others. But having a position of authority, could that bring some temptation there to misuse that authority and to become abusive, whether it's physically, verbally, or anything like that? Well, yes, and so he's making this teacher, giving this teaching here, that elders in the church cannot be like that, cannot be smiters or strikers. All right, the next one we see in 1 Timothy 3, verse 3, is the qualification for elders to not be greedy of filthy lucre. Now, we don't use the word lucre that much anymore, but this is a word that means, and this is one word in Greek, this translated here, not greedy, or the greedy of filthy lucre. He says don't be or not to be, but this phrase, greedy of filthy lucre, it's a word in Greek that means sordid or shameful gain. So they are not to be given to that, what we would call ill-gotten gain. So trying to get money in some way that is improper, that would be sordid or shameful. Well, elders in the church can't do that. This is a qualification we also see in the book of Titus, that being the other passage where the qualifications of elders are given. That's one that is also found in Titus chapter 1 and verse 7. So we find it in both passages with the qualifications of elders given, that they are not to be greedy of filthy lucre. Also in 1 Peter chapter 5, a passage that is addressed directly to elders in the church by the Apostle Peter, who was also an elder, that he makes mention of in verse 1 of 1 Peter 5. He is one who served in that capacity as an elder in the church, as well as being an apostle. And then he was giving instruction to the elders of the church. And in verse 2 says, feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. And if we're looking for reasons why this qualification would be given, and why this might be a temptation for certain men in their capacity as an elder in the church, we see a hint of, or more than a hint of it there in verse 2 here in 1 Peter 5, when he says for them to take the oversight of the flock willingly and not for filthy lucre, for this sordid or improper gain, shameful gain. Can an elder in the church receive financial support from the church for the work that they're doing for the body of Christ, where they're serving? Well, let's look at, the answer is yes, but let's look at 1 Timothy chapter 5 and see where this situation or scenario can come up. In fact, we see here in 1 Timothy 5 that the church is being instructed to help these ones financially, elders in the church that are serving in the capacity of being the ministers for the congregation, that is, the ones that are laboring in the word and doctrine. So here's a situation where one of the elders is holding the position or doing the majority of the work of preaching the word for the church. And so there's a work that they're doing really as on a full-time basis. They're serving the church as a preacher, teacher of the Word of God, also serving in the capacity of an elder. Well, is the church to help the ones that are laboring among them on a full-time basis like that? Or want those that are giving up their time, an opportunity where they could be making a living for themselves, but forsaking that so that they can labor for the church? Well, definitely. I mean, we have other passages, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, that speaks about that in a general sense as far as the church's responsibility to help support those that are doing the work among them in that fashion. Well, here he's talking specifically about an elder who's serving in this way. Let's look at 1 Timothy 5, 17 and 18. He says, "Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine. For the scripture saith, Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn, and the laborer is worthy of his hire." Well, what's the double honor here? Well, all elders are worthy of the honor for the congregation, for the souls that they are overseeing to be in subjection to them. But here is a double honor that they're worthy of if they're laboring in the word and doctrine, that is for the church to help them financially. And he says here, it quotes from that passage in Deuteronomy 25, verse 4, the ox is not to be muzzled, the one that treads out the corn, and the laborer is worthy of his reward. So there's a principle the church is to follow in general, but it also applies to elders. So if you have one who's an elder in the church, who's also laboring in the word and doctrine for the church, and then they're financially being financially supported, could that present an opportunity for someone serving in that way to become greedy of filthy lucre, to become given to a sordid gain for the work that they're doing? Well, there could be lots of opportunities in that position as an elder, whether they are being supported financially or not, to make compromises and to do wrong things because of a desire to get money out of it. Now, what is the root of all evil? 1 Timothy 6 and verse 10. And we know it's very true today as well as it's ever been. At the root of, if there's something evil going on, somewhere in there, at the root of it, there's going to be some covetousness involved, almost guaranteed. The love of money is the root of all evil. Well, this is also true. This can be something that could be a temptation for elders also. Might they be tempted to compromise what they're teaching or preaching for the sake of financial gain from that? Well, that could. And is it profitable? Is it financially profitable to teach false doctrine? The devil makes it so. He pays well his servants to do that work. I mean, that's just the truth of the matter. And that's always been who's the one given as the example in the New Testament as the model for that evil practice not to follow? In occasions like 2 Peter 2 and the book of Jude, Balaam, also in Revelation 2. Balaam is mentioned several times in the New Testament as really the example that false teachers follow in as far as his desire for money and what he was willing to do for the money. And he went to great lengths trying to have Israel cursed to the point where when God would not allow his mouth to do it, he taught the king of Moab to send in women to entice them to commit immorality and then also to teach them to worship idols. So he was intentionally setting up a stumbling block before them to teach them to do something wrong because he knew God would curse them. The Old Testament law, the law of Moses, said they would be cursed if they did those evils. So he got them cursed by God in that way. But he was willing to intentionally have a stumbling block put before their souls in order to accomplish that so that he could get the financial gain that he wanted as a reward from the king of Moab. He ended up losing his life shortly after that, but what was the worst part of it for him? I mean, where is he now? Where is he right now? And what's been going on with him for the last 3,000 years and more? About 3,500 years of torment. And that would be the worst part of it, of course. And then what eternity does he have to look forward to? There's nothing good that's worth what he did for himself and then all those who would follow him. And so elders in the church should not and must not have that temptation or fall to that temptation, for one thing, to change what they're doing and what they're teaching in order to gain more financially. And there's still a lot of money in false doctrine. You can just look around and see that's the case. There's nothing worth it. There's nothing of any value, eternally speaking, for falling to that. What else could be a temptation along those same lines? What's the work that elders have to do that we just saw in 1 Peter 5:2, taking the oversight of the church and of the souls there? Could there be situations where some might provide some financial enticement for some reason for them to judge a certain way or to do certain things in their capacity as an elder? That could happen, and if that the door was open for that, of course, the devil would use that readily. In 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 3, we read something very sad that happened in the Old Testament, where you had righteous Samuel, who was a prophet of the Lord and also a judge of Israel, but he had sons that he describes in 1 Samuel 8 verse 3, who walked not in his ways, not in the ways of Samuel their father, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment. Now that the devil could bring that temptation to elders in the church too, and they must not fall to it. Let's look at a couple of scriptures from Proverbs that go along with this and show why this is an evil practice. But Proverbs 15, verse 27. Proverbs 15, 27 says, "He that is greedy of gain troubleth his own house, but he that hateth gifts shall live." So there's going to be trouble on the part of those that are greedy and looking for some gain that they're going to sell their judgment for as a price, that they're willing to take money from somebody in order to render a certain decision or to follow a certain practice. And people will pay for that kind of stuff. It would be evil to give it, and there's lots of scriptures on that, but elders could never take something like that and pervert judgment. That's why that's one of their qualifications that they must not do. And also we can look at Proverbs 29 and verse 4, where he says, "The king by judgment establishes the land, but he that receives gifts overthrows it." Well, if an elder in the church took bribes, then they would also be guilty of overthrowing judgment. But by their judgment, righteous judgment, of course, the elders are going to then be helping to rule the church well, as they should, and be guiding the church and taking the oversight of the souls of the congregation. So they can't be ones that are given to having sordid or shameful gain, greedy of filthy lucre. That is one of the requirements for an elder, that they not do that. All right, the next thing in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 3, is the word patient. And if you were here this morning, as most of you were, we had a bit of a study on that word this morning, because it's a word that's also used in James chapter 3, verse 17, when he's teaching about the wisdom that is from above. And so we had an opportunity to look at this earlier the same day. But James chapter 3, verse 17 says, "But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy." It's translated gentle there, this word that means appropriate or mild. And this is a quality that elders must have in them. They have to be patient in the sense of being gentle and mild. Well, elders, and this goes right along here with not being a striker, and the next thing he says, not being a brawler. So what not to do and the way not to be is brought out here, but the way they should be. And actually, if we look further here at James 3, I mean, it's the wisdom that is devilish with the strife and wrath that he talks about in verses 14 through 16, where confusion and every evil work is. That's an earthly, a sensual, devilish wisdom. It's not from God. As opposed to this wisdom that is from above, that is from God, that is gentle, that is also, he says, pure and peaceable and easy to be entreated. Well, that wisdom is just, it couldn't be more different. It's opposite to that which he describes there as being this devilish wisdom. And we can see that being a striker and a brawler on the one hand versus being patient or gentle being mild in their manner. Well, this is a requirement for elders in the church, that they be patient in the sense of being gentle, mild. And this same word is used in several other places. Philippians 4:5, and I know we looked at some of these this morning. Philippians 4:5, where he says, "Let your moderation be made known unto all men." That word moderation, your gentleness, your mildness, that needs to be displayed towards everyone. Well, think of, again, about the role that, and by the way, as we studied this morning, we see that this is good for us all to be like. This word is used as just about all these words for qualifications of elders are used in other scriptures to teach all Christians to be this way. I mean, no Christian should be a striker or a brawler. No Christian should be greedy of filthy lucre. No Christian should be rough and harsh and given to fighting. We all need to be gentle, mild, but it's a requirement for elders in the church. Well, we need to do this towards all men, so do elders in the church. Think about their work. I mean, they've got all these souls to look after, and there are going to be times when weak ones don't behave properly, and they're going to have to deal with those situations. They're going to have to deal with a lot of difficult situations. Well, if their nature is to be soon angry and to get into fights and quarrels, and they are harsh and not gentle, I mean, what's that going to do to the church if they're the ones serving in the capacity of elders? You ever seen somebody who's serving as an elder, has the title, has the position, but they don't have this mild and gentle disposition, and you see the effect of it on the church? I mean, it will destroy a congregation if a leader is like that. We can't be that way. No Christian should be that way, but this is particularly dangerous for an elder in the church, and someone that has that kind of nature is not qualified. They shouldn't be in that position, and it should be easy to see why. It would be something very destructive to the church. This mildness, this gentleness must be there dealing with all the members of the body. In Titus chapter 3, verse 2, this is another passage we saw this morning, but he's teaching all of us as Christians to be this way. Titus 3, 2 says, "To speak evil of no man, to be no brawlers, but gentle, showing all meekness unto all men." That's what we all need to do, that word gentle there. And it goes right along with this meekness. But we need to be that way towards all men at all times. This is behavior that's becoming of all Christians, and it's absolutely necessary and required for elders in the church. The next one, similar to what we saw and in stark contrast to what we were just looking at with that word for being patient or gentle, he says in Titus or 1 Timothy 3, verse 3, not a brawler. That goes very closely together with not being a striker, and very much goes with being gentle, to not be a brawler. Well, this word brawler means not peaceable, and it comes from a word that means to battle or to war. And it's kind of interesting to see the places where it's used in that sense. If you want to, when he says, don't be this, if you see examples where people were that or what they were doing, it kind of brings it out pretty clearly what an elder shouldn't be. But if we look at some of the cases where people were battling and warring and these words were used, the one he says, don't be, we can see a good model for, or here in this case of what not to do. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 5 as one of these passages where he uses this word, a battling or a battle, which is what some people were doing. But 2 Corinthians 7, 5 says, "For when we were coming to Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were troubled on every side. Without were fightings, within were fears." Well, these were other people that were fighting with Paul and these ones who were doing right. And so here are the ones that were opposing the truth and the way they were doing it. He uses that word fightings. Well, they were warring. They were battling against Paul and against the ones that were laboring with him in the gospel. And so the ones on the outside, he said, were fighting with them. They were warring with them, battling with them. 2 Timothy chapter 2, he tells us, and this is speaking of Christians, again, all of us, here is what the manner that we should and should not have. 2 Timothy 2, verse 23, he says, "But foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing that they do gender strifes." This word strife is that word battling. They engender wars, battles, fights. That's the same word what he says elders are not to be. But he says, and this is what happens with these kinds of foolish and unlearned questions. Well, that's what results from them. He says, avoid that for that reason. Then he goes on to say in verse 24, "And the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patient." That word strive, that we must not do that. So instead of getting involved in these foolish questions, unlearned questions that bring out fights, we need to be able to teach and teach in a manner where we're not striving, but we're being gentle unto all men and patient and being meek, instructing those that oppose themselves, as he goes on to teach about in verse 25. And so we can try to recover these ones from the snare of the devil that are taken captive by him at his will. Well, we all need to be like that, but elders must be like that. Again, they cannot be involved in these fights. But that also requires that they be able to make that discernment what kinds of things to get involved in and what not to get involved in, and be able to recognize, well, here's some of these foolish and unlearned questions, and they're not going to get caught up in that where they become ones who are dragged into some kind of a battle or strife that's over something that is not appropriate. And there's several examples of that in these passages, but people do that, try to get us into some foolish argument that has, there's no reason we should even be involved in the discussion. It's just foolishness. But we need to recognize when that temptation is brought there and not get into it. But elders have to be able to do that and display that kind of wisdom and growth so that they're not going to be involved in that kind of behavior. They're not going to be battling and warring. Also in Titus 3 verse 9, he says, "But avoid foolish questions and genealogies and contentions and strivings about the law, for they're unprofitable and vain." Goes right along with what we were just seeing there in 2 Timothy chapter 2. So here again are these ones that will bring up these different things to fight about and get into arguments over, but they have no basis in anything that has to do with the truth. And so those are things that just need to be avoided altogether. Stop fighting about things like that. Well, elders shouldn't be, must not be. None of us should be. And so he's telling us to avoid this kind of thing and the battlings, the wars, the brawlings that result from that. So this is something that must not be engaged in. So we have a few passages where those same words are used, where we're taught this is not the way to behave as Christians. James 4, 1 and 2 will be the last one we look at here on this. "From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lust that war in your members? You lust and have not, you kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet you have not because you ask not." Well, here he's talking about certain ones that are involved in all that. They're fighting and warring all the time. And we see people with those kinds of characteristics sometimes. Everywhere they are, there's always turmoil and strife around them. They're getting into arguments and fights everywhere. Some people even seem to enjoy that. But this is not behavior that would be consistent with somebody who's qualified to be an elder in the church. They can't be involved in that kind of thing at all. Going along with this, as we've seen the teaching here in this verse, 1 Timothy 3, verse 3, to be gentle, not to be a striker or a brawler. Does all of that suggest that an elder needs to be in control of himself and needs to be gentle and not soon angry? And by the way, those are qualifications that we read about in the book of Titus, in Titus chapter 1, verse 7. The qualification is there, not soon angry. Also in verse 8 of Titus chapter 1, is the qualification to be temperate, that is, to have self-control. There's several of these that all go together. But being in control, not being soon angry, being gentle, patient or mild, and not being a striker and a brawler. You can see how all of these things fit together. And this is the kind of disposition, the kind of manner, the kind of heart that an elder in the Lord's church must have. which will be absolutely necessary to be able to properly carry out their duties in serving as elders in the church, as overseers of the flock and all of the souls in it. The men that are serving in that capacity must have all these qualifications, and we should be able to see why. All right, then the last one in verse 3 of 1 Timothy 3, he says, not covetous. Now, we've already looked at the one where he says, not greedy of filthy lucre. So this kind of goes along with that, too. Not covetous. This word, this isn't the common word for being covetous. This is a word that means, literally, it's not fond of silver. Literally, that's what the word is. Not fond of silver. Silver meaning lies in where the coins would come from. So they are not going to be fond of that. That's not where their heart's going to be. That they're not going to be given or bent that way at all, where they're going to desire to be given some financial reward. Now, before we saw it in the context of sordid or shameful gain. Well, somebody in covetousness is going to be at the heart of that, a love of money, where somebody's willing to get gain in a manner that is improper. Well, here it may be getting it properly, but if that's what they're fond of or given to, would that be acceptable for an elder in the church? So there can be no covetousness there at all, no fondness for money, and whether it's of sordid type or not. So he really covers both sides with those qualifications. Not greedy of filthy lucre, and here it's not covetous, not being fond of silver, not loving lucre at all, is really what that's teaching there. The only time that this exact word is used in the New Testament where he says not fond of silver is in Hebrews 13, verse 5. The only other place this particular word is used. Hebrews 13, 5 says, let your conversation be without covetousness, your behavior. And this is, again, for all Christians. So how many of these do we see that he says elders must be like this, but he also teaches in the New Testament all Christians should also be striving for this, not to be covetous, without covetousness. And he says, and be content with such things as you have, for he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. So our behavior should be without covetousness, that is, without a fondness for silver. And he says, be content with such things as you have. Well, there's the opposite. If we're content with what we have and we're not given to being fond of material things, having a love for these material things, we'll be content with what we have, and we're going to be able to avoid all the temptations that are going to come, that would come as a result of being covetous. A couple of times where the word is used without, where if you want to look at a couple of cases where we see a fondness for silver, that word used, and again, it's not the common word for covetousness, but it is used a couple of times. The Pharisees in Luke 16 that Jesus was teaching here, they are described as being covetous, which literally means they were, this is the word, fond of silver. They were this. What elders are told must not be, and all Christians in Hebrews 13, 5 are told not to be. Well, they were. Luke chapter 16, in verse 13, Jesus said, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. You cannot serve God in material things. That's what mammon means. Now, verse 14 says, the Pharisees also who were covetous, they were fond of silver. So being covetous, what did they think of this teaching that you cannot serve two masters, that you cannot serve God and material things? Well, they didn't like that sermon at all. And so it says they were covetous and they derided him in verse 14. That's what they did when they heard that teaching. They were guilty and they knew it, so they derided Jesus and what he was saying. They were mocking, laughing at, ridiculing him for what he was saying. People will use that tactic to try to intimidate the person who's teaching those kinds of things to stop teaching it. They didn't want to hear that, so they were trying to put it away and get it stopped. And so they were deriding and ridiculing him for what he was saying. And also people will, that's a form of pride, and If people can oppose something in that way, it makes them feel better about their own position to laugh at the opposite of what they believe and what they're doing. But all the laughter and derision and ridicule in the world wouldn't change the truth of it, would it? In fact, that's what Jesus said in verse 15. He said to them, "Ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God." What they were doing and the kind of hearts they had were abominable to God. We just recently studied in our gospel meeting about what those seven abominations to God in Proverbs chapter 6, 16 through 19. Well, here he talks about what is an abomination in the sight of God. And things that men esteem, he says, are what is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. So there's a good rule of thumb to follow. If we want to know what God hates, look at what the world loves. And that will tell us pretty well right there. And does this world is this world fond of silver? Is this a covetous world that we live in? Is it ever? And what does God think of that? That's abomination in His sight. He says you cannot serve God and mammon. We cannot have Christ as our master and also love material things. 1 John 2:15, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him, he says. We can't do both. Now, can we understand why an elder in the church could not be like this? They wouldn't be able to have Christ as their master if they're loving and serving material things. And so this is why he makes it clear. Not only can they not be guilty of being given to sordid or shameful gain, filthy lucre, but they're not to be covetous at all. They're not to have that quality in them at all. They have to be ones who have Christ as their only master. It should be clear that He is their only master, that they are not loving material things. If we want to look at what can happen to a congregation that has that problem, and we're not given the details of which men served as elders over time in Ephesus. But we do have a glimpse of that congregation and the eldership of that congregation, tracing it through scriptures over time. In Acts chapter 20, were there elders in Ephesus? That's who Paul was meeting with in Acts 20 and was warning them about what could happen and what would happen. As he was warning them to be on guard, as he had been warning them for day and night for 3 years with tears. And he told them in verse 29, he says, "For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. And of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after them." He says, among you, and he's talking to the elders. He was warning them, be on the lookout, because among you, among the eldership, men are going to arise that are going to be doing these things. What would be the effect on the congregation? Well, what do we know that happened? This is at the end of Paul's third missionary journey. The book of Ephesians is written when he's in prison in Rome. It's one of the prison epistles, the one we're studying right now Wednesday nights. So just a few years after Acts 20, that epistle is given. Well, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of AD 60 to 64. A little over 30 years into the future, 30 to 35 years after that, we get to the close of the New Testament time in the book of Revelation. In chapter 2, one of the seven letters to the churches in Asia, the first one that we have is to the church at Ephesus. What was going on there these many years later? Well, did any men arise among the eldership that had a bad influence on them? Well, it appears that was the case. I mean, Paul said it was going to happen and warned them about it. And one of the problems that we see in Ephesus, the big problem that was threatening their having a candlestick. And if we want to understand the significance of that, Jesus is described as being the one walking among the candlesticks. And that's how he's described there in chapter 1. They're walking among the candlesticks there. In Revelation chapter 1 and verse 20, and these are the seven churches of Asia. So if Jesus is walking among the candlesticks and then a church doesn't have one, what does that say? Jesus isn't walking among them. So if we want to understand whether that's really an important or significant thing, it is. It has total significance. If we don't have a candlestick, Jesus isn't among us. Then that means he doesn't recognize us as belonging to him as being one of his churches. Now, Sardis had the name in chapter 3. It's the first one we read about in chapter 3 that a letter was written to. And it says, you have a name that you live, but you're dead. So just having the right name on the signboard out there, I mean, that's, we have to have the right name. We have to have the Lord's name. We belong to him. But if that's all we've got, is that, are we his? Well, he says, no, that was a problem in Sardis. Well, Ephesus, they had the right name too. They had a lot of other things that were right. They weren't dead. They were opposing false doctrine. They couldn't bear them, which are evil, Revelation 2, verse 2. They had tried ones who were false apostles and found them liars. They had borne, they had patience. For Christ's name's sake, they had labored and not fainted. But then he says in verse 4, I have somewhat against you because you've left your first love. And warn them in verse 5 to remember from where they had fallen and repent and do the first works, he says, or else I will come unto thee quickly and will remove thy candlestick out of his place, except thou repent. Now, from the outside, and I think we've mentioned this before, I mean, if we really didn't know that congregation well and we just happened to visit during one of their one of their services, if we happened to be traveling through Ephesus during that time, we stopped over, went in the congregation there, attended there, what would it look like to us? Would we have heard the truth preached? He said they couldn't bear what was evil. They opposed false doctrine. Goes on to talk about that in verse 6. They hated the deeds of the Nicolaitans. There were those false teachers around. They wouldn't put up with that. We would have heard the truth. We would have heard the New Testament preached and preached properly. We would have seen that commitment to truth. Would we have been impressed? Certainly in contrast to five of those other congregations, yes. Unfortunately, it looks like that in our day and time too. I mean, we have so many that have gone off on that. But it would have looked good, but Jesus could see into the hearts of the people and he could see a problem that they had. And he said, you've left your first love. What's the first commandment? To love God with all of our heart and soul and mind and strength. What does he say there in Luke 16 and also 1 John 2, 15-17? What will prevent us from being able to love God? You cannot serve God. You cannot love God and the things of the world. You cannot serve God and material things. Did they have a problem with that? And could that have also been a problem among the eldership? I mean, it's not a far-fetched thing there based on the things that we are told. And the Ephesus was told about the church at Ephesus and see what things they were warned about and what did actually happen. They had a problem there with those things. So it shouldn't be a surprise to us that he would make that a qualification. Elders in the church must not be covetous men. They must not be men that have a love for material things. And that needs to be demonstrated in their lives that they're not given that way. That they don't love the world. Because you can see the effect it can have on the church. It can take the whole church away from the first love. Even if they're still preaching and teaching the right things. If they don't have that love for God because they love this world, what's going to happen? The candlestick will be gone. The souls will be lost ultimately. So that's why that is so important. They've got to guide the church and do so, of course, in the right way, which is going to require that they not be covetous men. In fact, he uses that same word, fondness for silver there in 2 Timothy 3, 1 and 2, that's a characteristic of people in perilous times in this world. He says those perilous times will come, and he says, describing what people are going to be like during such times in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, he says, men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous. And he describes a bunch of other things that describe our society right now, just absolutely to a T. Boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection. I mean, that is a list that describes what's right around us right now perfectly, unfortunately. But again, he uses that word, having a love for or fondness for silver, covetousness. That's one of the characteristics that he said would be of the world in such perilous times. Well, elders in the church can't be like that. They can't be like that at all. All right, that looks or completes verse 3 of 1 Timothy 3. Verses 4 and 5 are pertaining to the qualifications of the family, which will go along with one of the major or more details that we have in the qualifications in Titus chapter 1. And you may recall we mentioned that we would like to look at that as a separate entity. There are two other verses after that that have two other qualifications, not being a novice and having a good report of those that are without. And we want to look at those two in the next lesson, those ones from verses 6 and 7. So for now, we want to skip verses 4 and 5, and we'll look at that together when we tie that in with what we see in Titus 1. We want to save that one for the end, is what we're getting at there. And we'll also have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in Titus 1 that we haven't already seen as parallel qualifications in our study of 1 Timothy 3. So we've got two more in 1 Timothy 3, eight more in Titus 1, and then we've got the family qualification. So we got a little bit more ground to cover yet, but we've looked at quite a bit already. By my count, we've already gone through 15. So we're most of the way there. But anyway, there's a lot to learn in studying these things to understand what these qualifications are about for elders in the church. Also to understand better the kind of people we need to be as Christians in general. So it should be helpful to us in all those respects, and hope that it has been so far and will continue to be as we study these things out. But we do appreciate everybody being here tonight, and I encourage you to be back for the future lessons in this study. Lord willing, next Sunday night we're having a singing, so we will resume this, Lord willing, in 2 weeks' time. And then at the close here tonight, we want to take this opportunity to extend the Lord's invitation.